She hadn't even known that this man was capable of fear, and now he seemed to be nothing but a quivering mass of it. Anything else?
One disturbing report. When your soldiers meet in secret, my people are always watching. 2 days ago, a group of 10 lieutenants met down in an abandoned house in the southern district.
And?
They met with 2 priests.
Tyr priests?
Yes, Majesty. We did not recognize the second, but the man in charge was Father Ryan, he who took over as the Pope's right hand when Brother Matthew was executed.
The Queen's lips pulled back in a snarl. The Tyr Pope's principles were so flimsy as to be nearly transparent, and the bargain he had struck with the Queen now sat in limbo. The Pope had failed to kill the girl, and the Queen had withdrawn her army. She would not touch the Tyrling further. Even though the jewels appeared lifeless, she had sworn an oath upon them, one she did not dare test. But she should have known that the two-faced bastard in the Arvath would now be seeking his own accommodation. She longed to have his neck in her hands.
"The substance of this meeting?"
she demanded.
"I don't know yet, Majesty. I have 2 of the lieutenants in custody, but they have not broken."
"Break them now."
"Of course, Majesty."
But Dukat sounded discouraged, and the Queen heard his unspoken thought easily. It was so hard to keep people from plotting in the dark.
"Evie, Christ God, shut up," she whispered.
"Majesty."
"Nothing."
The Queen rubbed her temples, willing her mind to be silent. The girl had done quite a number on Dukat, but he wasn't alone. The Queen, who believed she had killed off Evelyn Rali long ago, now found her mind peopled with Evelyn's unquiet ghosts. She needed peace, time to sit and think, to figure out what to do. Some tea and a hot bath. Answers would come, and if they didn't, she could at least take a nap. Remove some of the muddle that seemed to cover her mind at all times these days. She had been so sure that the Tyr sapphires would cure her insomnia, but of course they had not done this either, and now every day seemed to be about recovering the sleep she had lost the night before. A light clang of steel echoed in the air. Out of old instinct, the Queen sprang from her throne and leapt off the side of the dais, landing in a crouch. Something thudded against the back of her throne, but she was already scurrying behind one of the enormous pillars that sat on either side of the dais. Her mind clocked glimpses of activity. Dukat grappling with one of his lieutenants, a knife lying at the foot of the stairs, the other lieutenant stalking toward the pillar, sword in hand. Assassination, the Queen thought, almost bemused at the idea. It was an old game, but it had been a long time since anyone had dared to play it here. She pressed her body against the smooth, rounded surface of the pillar, her mind working rapidly. The army was discontented, yes, but discontent alone would never drive them to such a drastic move. They thought her vulnerable somehow. Did they think she had left the Tyr intact out of weakness? Intolerable. Could Dukat be in on it? She thought not. More likely Dukat was a secondary target. No one loved him, not even his own troops. She sensed the second soldier coming for her now, could feel his heartbeat, light and rapid as a rabbit's, on the far side of the pillar. She could kill him easily, but two lieutenants had never hatched this plot on their own. She needed at least one of them alive. From the center of the room came the thick, gagging sound of a man being throttled. She hoped it wasn't Ducart, but was forced to concede that it might be. The assassin was edging around the curve of the pillar now, approaching her on her left. The queen tensed, preparing to go for his sword hand, but then something slammed into the pillar, an impact that the queen felt even through 10 feet of solid stone. The man's sword clattered to the ground in front of her.
"Majesty, you are well?"
The words were spoken with a heavy tear accent. The queen peeked around the pillar and found one of her pages, the new girl that Juliet had selected when Mina died. The queen could not remember her name. Continuing around the curve, she found that the girl held the lieutenant up against the pillar, his face smashed into the stone and a knife to his throat. The queen couldn't help being impressed. Though tall and muscular for a woman, all of the queen's pages were built so, the girl was still smaller than the soldier, but she held the lieutenant immobilized. The state of the throne room said a great deal. Juliet had not moved, nor had the rest of the pages. The queen's guard captain, Guilaine, was just pulling Ducart from beneath his attacker, and even from here the queen could see the ugly bruises forming on Ducart's throat. The other lieutenant was dead, knifed in the back. Most of the queen's private guard still lined the walls, sharp eyes watching her every movement. They had barely even stirred. "Good God," the queen thought, "my own guard." She turned back to the new page.
"What is your name?"
"Emily, Majesty."
"Benin, are you well enough to take a prisoner?"
"I'm fine,"
Ducart spat, nearly snarling.
"He blindsided me."
The queen's lips tightened. No one ever took Ducart by surprise. She turned back to the girl, Emily, sizing her up. Good tear stock, tall and blonde, tightly corded muscles in her arms, pretty, but not bright. Her face had that dull look which the queen had always associated with the tier underclass.
"You came in the shipment,"
the queen remarked.
"Yes, Majesty,"
the girl replied in a mixture of tear and broken mort.
"A page I'm chosen, last month only."
A page who couldn't even speak the language properly. Juliet must have been desperate. And yet, given the events of the past few minutes, the queen couldn't really fault the choice. She could have dealt with the assassins herself, but that didn't matter. Of all the people in the room, only two had acted, Guilaine and the slave. Competent mort speakers were abundant, but loyalty was in very short supply these days. What a pity the girl was a tear.
"Give him to General Ducart," she told Emily. "Benin, I want names."
"Yes, Majesty,"
Ducart replied, dragging himself to his feet. The new page handed the prisoner over while the queen kept a careful eye on Juliet, who was working hard to conceal her anxiety. Whether that indicated guilt, the queen couldn't say. Treachery seemed to surround her now. It was like the old tear tale, the lonely dictator, safe in his castle, so well guarded that he could not leave. Ducart had warned her that withdrawing the army would cause a real problem, and now she realized that he had understood his men better than she had. She should have listened. As Ducart began marching his prisoner to the door, the queen found herself forced to face an unpleasant truth. This miserable man was the closest thing she had to a friend. Alone, neither of them would last very long.
"Benin?"
He turned back.
Majesty.
The Queen took a deep breath, feeling as though she had to coax each word from her throat. Asking for help. It was the most difficult thing, the most terrible thing. But she had run out of options. It is only you and I now, Benin. You see? Ducat nodded, his face twitching, and the Queen made a startling discovery. He found her just as unpleasant as she found him. That would be something to think on. But later, when this crisis was over, when she'd finally had one good night's sleep.
Go.
Ducat left, pushing the army lieutenant in front of him. There was probably nothing to be extracted from the man anyway. A dissatisfied army made for fruitful recruiting, but the clever conspirator never told the assassin anything. And her unseen adversary, this Le Vieux, was nothing if not clever. The Queen seated herself on her throne again, staring at the menagerie of potential traitors before her. Guards, pages, soldiers, courtiers, at least 30 people, all of them scheming to bring her down. Juliet had begun to arrange for removal of the corpse on the floor, but her eyes darted constantly to the Queen, fearful. The Queen sought out the tear girl, who had retreated to stand against the wall with the other pages. She should dig into the girl's background, find out where a tear woman had learned to handle a knife like that. But that was for later. There were too many things to worry about now. Entire villages had disappeared, fleeing from the Glace Verte. The Queen no longer commanded an army, only a bunch of cutthroats. The Orphan, the Dark Thing, whatever name he travelled under, he was coming, and she had nothing with which to stop him. The girl might be of use, but she was a dangerous uncertainty. And the Queen hated uncertainty above all things. She felt a sudden urge to scream, to throw something, anything to stop all of these people from staring at her, waiting for her to make another mistake. "Emily, is it?" she asked the slave.
"Yes, Majesty."
The Queen stared at her for a moment longer, sizing her up. She could not trust anyone, she realized now, but perhaps a tear slave was a better choice than most. By and large, the tear who came in the shipment retained no loyalty to their kingdom. They were more likely to feel active hate. It was a risk, and a large one, to give a tear slave access to the tear queen. But the girl had at least acted, damn it. And that was more than the Queen could say for most of the room, even her own guards. Again she thought with longing of Beryl, of a time when loyalty had not been a choice between evils.
"You are no longer a page," the Queen told her. "Yours is a special assignment. Go down to my dungeons. I want a full report on the status of the Tear Queen. Where is she? What are her conditions? Find out if she has made any requests of her jailers."
The girl nodded, shooting a triumphant glance at Juliet, whose face darkened further. No love lost there. A good sign.
"And get yourself a mort, tutor. Learn fast. I want to hear no tear words out of your mouth."
Another good sign, Emily neither talked back nor asked questions, only nodded and left. The Queen returned to her throne, but once there, it seemed she could do nothing but stare at the fresh bloodstain on the floor. rebellion and revolt. No ruler had ever held such things down for long. Not by force. Le Vieux and the Dark Thing. For a moment she wondered if they might be working together. But no, the Dark Thing would never condescend to work with anyone. Even the Queen, who had thought they were partners, had only been a pawn to him. The Dark Thing would wait until she was weak, until the rebellion raging across Mortmain had taken its worst toll, and then it would come for her. I could flee, the Queen thought, but it was an empty idea at best. She was equally hated in both Kader and Calais. That left the north, where the Dark Thing waited, and west, the worst option of all. If the Tear got hold of her, they would stretch her to ribbons just to watch her scream. And even if she could flee into dark holes and shadowy corners, what kind of life would that be, when she was used to watching kingdoms dance at her command? Evie, come here. No, she whispered. Long before the Tear had sent its first shipment, she had already been a slave, and now she could never go back. She would rather be dead. She thought of her recurring nightmare, which had plagued her for months now. The last flight. The girl, the fire looming, the man in grey behind them. You will flee, the Dark Thing had told her. And perhaps she would, but only at the very end, when she had nothing left. She lifted her chin, staring at the room of traitors before her.
Next.
Chapter 3. Domain.
These people are so damned proud of their hatred. Hatred is easy and lazy to boot. It's love that demands effort. Love that exacts a price from each of us. Love costs. This is its value.
The Glynn Queen's words, as compiled by Father Tyler. In all his years of sneaking in and out of every venue imaginable, the Fetch had found that the most valuable skill was the correct stride. Too fast was suspicious, too slow was lost. But the right pace, the confident gait of one who belonged there, these things had an almost magical power to set guards and sentries at ease. He padded stolidly up the stairs, the walk of a much heavier man who did not relish his destination. He wore the cloak of one of the Arvath guards, but beneath the hood his eyes darted everywhere, looking for movement. It was 3:30 in the morning, and most of the Arvath was asleep. But not all. The Fetch could hear the activity far above him, the sound of many voices drifting down the center of the staircase from the upper floors. A new mob. When the Holy Father had been anointed, the devout of the city had hailed the event in a 3-day waking fast before the Arvath. These same people thought the Holy Father would restore the glory of the Church, a glory that had steadily eroded since the Glynn Queen took the throne. It was from this demographic that the Holy Father assembled his mobs.
I could tell you,
the Fetch thought, the thought tinged with black inside his head, and now, instead of the Holy Father, he saw Roe, swathed in white.
I could tell you about God's Church.
The mobs were bad. They had already slaughtered several sinners in various corners of the city.
but there was worse to come. The new Holy Father had hired more than 25 bookkeepers for the Avath, but even a casual observer could see that these men were not accountants, but enforcers. Howell had followed several of them around the city, into the gut and the warehouse district, even down into the creche, where they dealt in whatever obscenity would give a good rate of return. Intuition told the Fetch that a vast criminal empire was being assembled here under the streets, in the dark. Of course, there were many gangsters in the Tierling. The Queen's treasurer was one of them. But this was the church, and the Fetch, who had once been a member of God's church in its infancy, felt the difference deep inside himself. Criminals and panderers. He didn't know why this fact should continue to surprise him. But the shame he felt now was the same shame he had felt then. Before he died, Thomas Rowley had told the Fetch that the crown was in the keeping of the Holy Father. Thomas had offered an infinite number of minor bribes to get it back, but he had at least had the presence of mind to withhold what the old Holy Father had really wanted, a permanent income tax exemption for the church. It was, after all, only a crown. Though the Fetch, who had always been able to read Thomas easily, saw a different truth in the condemned man's eyes. He had wanted the crown terribly. He had no idea of what it could do. For that matter, neither did the Fetch, but the silver circlet symbolized something that Thomas had needed to prove. In that final moment before execution, the Fetch had pitied him, but not enough to withhold the axe. Several weeks ago, just before the Queen's capture, Howell had picked up word that something had been stolen from the Avath. The Holy Father's enforcers didn't know that something from Adam, but they knew that it was kept in a polished cherrywood box. It was this information that had made Howell prick up his ears. The Fetch's men had never seen that box, but the Fetch had, long ago, in the hands of the man he had thought was his friend. Keeping it out of Roe's hands was paramount. But there were other hands, almost as bad. The entire church was on the lookout for the keep priest, Father Tyler, and the bounty on his head seemed to go up every day. If the keep priest had taken the crown, then the Fetch would not find it by skulking around the Avath. But yesterday he had spotted something interesting, and if life had taught him nothing else, it had taught him that more information was never a bad thing. The small facts one learned by accident often became useful later. Before him was a dark-haired woman sitting on a bench in the hallway that ran the length of the brothers' quarters. Her face had been sliced to ribbons by what looked like a straight razor. The cuts had not been stitched, leaving the woman's face a seamed patchwork of dried blood and infected flesh. She stared at the ground as the Fetch approached. Howell had not said anything about this woman, but the Fetch had picked up enough gossip in the kitchens to know that her name was Maya, and she had been one of the Holy Father's concubines. The Fetch, who knew a comer when he saw one, had kept a weather eye on Cardinal Anders for years. The man always had women, two of them, no more and no less. Though well hidden from the populace, these women were no secret in the Avath. They came from prostitution, and usually went back there when Anders was finished with them. But this one, Maya, would never be able to work again. Like all of the Holy Father's women, she was addicted to morphia. And the Fetch guessed that her addiction was the only thing that kept her sitting obediently on the bench. She might be looking no further than her next fix,
but the Fetch knew that her death could not be far behind. Still, she was a puzzle. Anders had never been one to cut his women. He was a violent man, for certain, but he had always reserved that violence for his anti-sodomy demonstrations. There was no attempt to hide Maya. She was out on full display. She was being punished, made an example of. He was determined to find out why. The Fetch tapped her on the shoulder, and she looked up. The slashes on her face were cruelly visible, even in the dim torchlight. One of them travelled up and over the bridge of her nose, very near to the corner of her eye. It looked as though her eye had wept blood, and this made the Fetch think again of Ro. In the excitement of discovering this woman, he had forgotten about the hell that was currently raining down on the northern end of both kingdoms, Tyr and Mortmain. That was one of Ro's many dangers. He was so damnably easy to ignore, until it was too late. "You are the Fetch," Maya murmured. For a moment he was stunned, and then he remembered that he was wearing his mask. He often forgot about it. He was so used to its leathery feel that it often seemed like part of his face. Far away, deep in the bowels of the Avath, he heard a clock strike 2. "What do you want with me?" she asked. The Fetch touched a light hand to her hair, brushing it away from her forehead. He had often used artifice to get what he wanted, particularly from women, but there was no art here. The Tierling was full of battery, but the Fetch had rarely seen any woman so poorly used as this one. For a moment, the Fetch seemed to hear William Tyr's voice deep in his mind. "God does not keep his hands to himself. Believe or not, your neighbor's belief will wound you just as surely as your own." The Fetch nearly groaned. They had heard, all of them, they had heard William Tyr speak these words, or some variation thereof, many times. But they had never listened. To all of them, born after the crossing, with no frame of reference, Tyr's words were merely so much breath. The Fetch had belonged to God's church long enough to know that the carnage before him was nothing to do with God or good. Brutality found such great camouflage under the cross.
"We didn't listen." "No, you didn't listen. Katie listened."
That was true. She had. And she had paid for it, forced into exile, her belly great with Jonathan's child. More than anything, the Fetch suddenly wished that he might have 5 minutes with Katie just to apologize, to tell her that she had been right. The younger Gavin had been too proud even to think of apologizing, but the Fetch had found that age brought that need to even scores and make things right. But it was many long years too late to beg forgiveness of Katie. There was only the woman in front of him, her face a path of razors.
"Why has he done this to you?"
the Fetch asked. "Because I let the Keep Priest get away."
"Why?"
Maya stared at him blearily. "The old man was kind. He listened. He said the Queen was good." She paused, looking around her, and the Fetch realized that he'd been wrong. She was immobilized not by morphia, but by withdrawal. The skin of her neck and shoulders was damp with sweat. good," Maya continued, her voice growing hoarse now. Her muscles were spasming, constricting her vocal cords. "He said she was good. And I thought, well, if she is good, then Anders shouldn't be allowed to keep it from her. He shouldn't be allowed to do that."
"Keep what?"
"The crown. He liked to try it on when no one was looking. And even when I was deep under the spoon, I would think, it's not his. It belongs to the Queen. He shouldn't get to wear it." She blinked slowly, the fetch thought that she must be very close to sinking into unconsciousness. "When the old man came, I saw my moment. And I jumped." The fetch needed to ask her more, but his time was running out.
"This crown, what did it look like?"
"Silver. A circle. Blue sapphires. And a pretty box."
"And the keep priest took it away?"
She nodded.
"Where is he?"
"I don't know. They said he got away. Took Father Seth with him. When Anders found out, he cut my face." The fetch frowned, his stomach twisting. Few in the Tyr knew that the silver circlet the Raleighs had worn for centuries was only an imitation. The real crown had disappeared completely, along with its cherrywood box. The fetch suspected that Katie had taken it with her, but he had never been sure. Regardless of where the crown was now, for at least a brief moment, it had been here in the Arvath, and he had lost it. Two cloistered Arvath priests, on their own, in New London? The thought made him shudder.
"Do they feed you?"
he asked Maya. "Yes. Every day a tiny dose. Not nearly enough." The fetch grimaced. "You will not stay? Keep me company?" Maya asked. "I'm not afraid of your mask."
"Then you would be the first,"
the fetch murmured. Even he himself had become afraid of the mask, for he no longer knew which was the real man beneath. The outlaw? The rueful traitor who had been forced into hiding, donning the mask only because he could no longer stand the idea that he might be recognized? Or was it a boy named Gavin? A boy who had wanted so badly to be right, to be clever, that he had been easy pickings for the cleverest manipulator of them all.
"Which are you?"
He didn't know. He had been walking the Tyr for more than 300 years, and sometimes he felt that he was not one man, only a collection of phases, several different men with their own lifetimes.
"But which are you now?"
His mind hammered relentlessly.
"Which man have you become?"
Ah. There was the question. The boy Gavin would have left the mutilated woman before him on the bench, her purpose served, information extracted. The man, the fetch, might have rescued her, but only to increase the glory of his legend, as when he had once stolen an unhappy concubine from right under Thomas Raleigh's nose. He dug deep into the inner pocket of his shirt and came up with a cloth-wrapped packet. Inside were several needles and a good quantity of high-grade morphia. He had not expected to need these things, but had brought them along just in case. Now, he unwrapped the cloth and snapped his fingers before Maya's face.
"Listen."
He pressed the vials into her hand.
"These are for you. Hide them away.
and hide them well.
Her gaze sharpened as she focused on the needles.
For me?
Yes, just in case.
He patted her cheek to make her look at him.
This is the Grand Mile grade. Powerful. Far more powerful even than what you were getting from the Holy Father. If you took it all at once, you wouldn't live out the night.
She looked up at him steadily, clenching the packet in her fist. The fetch tiptoed backward, leaving her on the bench. Briefly, he considered going upstairs and ending the Holy Father once and for all, but then he realized that he could not. He might need the man in the end. And even if not, there were ranks of eager priests, perhaps worse, waiting behind him. No. Better to simply fade away, vanish, as he had always done. And yet he couldn't help loathing himself.
Dear God, he whispered.
And even though he was currently walking through the oldest house of worship in the New World, he knew he was talking to no one at all. If God had ever been in the Tearling, he was long gone. Javel could not stand still. He had spent most of the morning pacing in front of the window, which was spattered with tiny droplets. Cold rain had been falling in Domain on and off for the past 2 weeks, and the unpaved streets of this neighbourhood, the Breen, were nothing but a wet bog. Winter came to the Mort capital several weeks earlier than it did to New London. Javel was grateful that Galen had insisted they bring heavier clothing. Sometimes Galen's caution was annoying, like having a mother along. But more often than not, that caution was also justified. Javel had learned to trust the man's instincts, and several days ago, when Galen suggested that it was time to move along to new quarters, they had packed up and moved into the Breen. Javel had not expected to like Domain. Even before it had taken Allie from him, Mortmain had been a dark realm, evil kingdom in the fairy tales Javel had heard growing up. But Domain was, after all, only a city. Buildings and alleys and streets. And Javel had been a city dweller all his life. Domain was bigger than New London, and boasted impressive construction, most of its buildings made of brick instead of wood. The streets gleamed with windows, for glass was nearly as cheap as brick in Mortmain, the result of a glut of supply from Cadair. The Red Queen was no fool. She'd made sure that glass was affordable even for Mortmain's poor. The city was filled with such small gestures, the trappings of quality of life, plazas and public parks. It was the facade of an easy, open land, incongruous with the image of Mortmain that Javel had always carried in his head. But the plazas and parks were actually under close surveillance by the Queen's internal security, watching to see who gathered with whom. The windows meant that very little could be hidden.
"Calm yourself, gate guard," Galen murmured from the desk, where he was busy writing a message to the mace. "You'll wear out the rug."
Javel halted in front of the window. Once still, he could feel steady pounding under his feet. Steel foundries, brick kilns, and many other types of industry operated beneath the streets, and the noise was horrendous, even indoors. The racket made ground floor space extremely cheap, and they had been at Michael John's pub for 2 days now, paying daily rent to the extremely bad-tempered publican. Galen, ever cautious, had expressed some concern about asking Javel to stay in a pub, but Galen needn't have worried. Demain's pubs were not like those of New London, dark holes where a man could get lost and drown. And Javel had never felt less like drinking in his life. Dyer had been gone all night, but soon he would return. And if he'd been successful, he would return with Ali's location. They were a badly mismatched group. Queen's Guard or not, Galen was too old for such an enterprise. Dyer and Javel had reached an uneasy balance of civility and mistrust, but Javel knew that, all things being equal, Dyer would like nothing better than to run him through. Dyer often baited him, and it was an easy business, for Javel could not argue with Dyer's two recurring themes. Javel was a traitor, and Javel was a drunk. Several times Galen had broken them up when the argument was just about to tip over into violence, though Javel knew he would come off badly in such a brawl, but any truce they made was no more than temporary. Dyer loathed him, and Javel often considered telling the truth and saving him some time. Dyer could not possibly hate Javel more than he hated himself. But their odd partnership was often effective. Galen, who had grown up in a border village, spoke excellent Mort, good enough to blend in with the people of the city. They let him do most of the talking. Dyer spoke good Mort, but with a slight accent that might be picked up by a keen ear, and Javel, who did not speak Mort, was not allowed to talk at all. Javel had to admit that Galen was a savvy negotiator. He'd gotten them the rooms in Michael John's for next to nothing, and even more importantly, he'd ensured that the landlord would leave them alone. Then there was Dyer. Javel had assumed that Dyer had been sent along primarily as a sword, for he was well known to be one of the Queen's best. But he had other talents. It had taken him only 2 days to pick up a girl in the auctioneer's office. Since then, there had been several more meetings, from each of which Dyer returned with an increasingly unbearable air of having made sacrifice for Queen and country. The three of them were posing as merchants up from the south, and Dyer was also feigning a gruesome interest in the slave trade. Last night, the girl had been meant to show him the auctioneer's office itself, but when Javel woke this morning, Dyer still hadn't returned. Now Javel could do nothing but pace in front of the window. The auctioneer's list held the name, location, and origin of every slave in Mort Main, for Gambroussard's office was nearly as efficient as Thorne's former census bureau. Word had reached Demain almost a month ago. Arlen Thorne was dead. The Glynn Queen had ended him, and even the Mort consensus seemed to be good riddance. But for Javel, the news of Thorne's death had not brought the satisfaction he might have expected, only a sense of futility. He would have bet his last pound that Thorne had died believing he had done nothing wrong. But even if the man had discovered some late form of repentance, the world remained full of Thorns.
"You're pacing again," Galen remarked. "If you can't keep it together, I'll have to tie you to a chair."
"Sorry," Javel muttered, forcing himself to be still. It was a terrible thing, having hope. Sometimes he longed for the old days. The last 6 years in New London had been miserable, yes, but at least there had been a cold certainty there. Outside, the rain had changed from a steady drizzle into a downpour, and on both sides of the street, the vendors hawking their wares had begun to close up shop. Just beneath Javel, on the sidewalk outside, was a pile of curdled horse droppings that no one had bothered to clean up. Abundant windows or not, this wasn't a good neighborhood. Although Demain didn't have an area comparable to the Gut, where nearly everyone was up to no good, in his exploration of the city, Javel had found plenty of neighborhoods that the Red Queen's improvements had failed to reach, where decay had set in. He had plotted these places on a map in his head. This was his usefulness, the reason he didn't feel like completely dead weight on this enterprise. Dyer had spent most of his life in the keep, and Galen was more or less a country boy turned guard. Both of them were intimidated by Domain's size, its navigational difficulty, and whenever they had a question about the city's geography, they turned to Javel. In his 20 minutes next to the window, Javel had already seen 3 troops of Mort soldiers go by. Despite the lack of a gut, in some ways the vast majority of the city was nothing else. Everyone doing what they had to and looking the other way. The people of Domain didn't seem to consider themselves under martial law, but the city's standing police force roved the streets ceaselessly. Javel had seen no real unrest, though Galen had pointed out that the Tierling, even under Thomas Rali, had always had a much higher tolerance for civil unrest than Mort Main. Galen said the soldiers were an anticipatory measure, and he was right. Even 3 strangers could feel the difference in the city now, the rumblings of discontent in quiet quarters. Galen, who never forgot that he was a Queen's Guard, liked to sit in the pubs at night, making a mug of ale last for hours while acting as the mace's ears. And lately, he'd heard plenty. The Queen of the Tierling, widely acknowledged by Domain to be a fearsome sorceress, had marched into the Mort camp and turned back the Mort army at the very gates of New London, just as her mother had done, though no one quite seemed to know how. Javel wondered briefly if the Queen had reinstituted the shipment, but then dismissed the idea. He was no sycophant, like Galen and Dyer, but he had never forgotten the woman he had seen on the keep lawn, the woman who had opened the cages. She would cut her own throat before reviving the slave traffic. Both Dyer and Galen were anxious over the Queen, though each tried to hide it, but there was no more news to be had of her, not in any pub. The rest of the gossip was of Mortmain's difficulties, and they were many. Some sort of plague was crossing the Northland, emptying villages and scattering the inhabitants. A rebellion was raging in the northern cities, Cité Marche and Arc Nord. The rebels were moving their resistance down to Domain, and Domain was waiting for them. Without flesh to peddle, many in the city had lost their jobs, and many more in other industries had temporarily lost their regular subsidy of labour from the Crown. Even the girl in the auctioneer's office had confided to Dyer that she lived in fear of being sacked. Domain's economy grew increasingly shaky, and all corners of the city placed the blame squarely on the Red Queen. The invasion of the Tierling, which should have injected some badly needed wealth into the city when the army returned, had yielded nothing. Javel had assumed that the return of the soldiers would calm the city's unrest, but instead, the Red Queen had found her problems compounded. The 2 guards seemed to think that all of this chaos was good, that it would make their job easier. Javel hoped they were right.
"Sir?"
A fist pounded on the door. The voice was Dyer's, and Javel realized, disgruntled, that Dyer had snuck past him somehow. At a nod from Galen, he went to unlock the door and was nearly thrown backward as Dyer burst into the room panting.
"Sir, come! Now!"
Galen stood and grabbed his coat. This was a thing Javel had learned to admire about the Queen's Guard. No arguing, not even petty bickering, all questions cleared to one side in the expedience of the moment.
He wanted to ask about Ali, but Galen's professionalism had shamed him into silence. No one had invited him, but he followed them anyway, carefully locking the door of their rooms behind him. He was forced to hurry, for the two guards pounded down past the glaring publican and did not slow until they reached the street. The rain had reduced to drizzle again, almost a mist. The air was rank with the acrid smell of steam from the steel foundries. Above the buildings to their right, Javel could just glimpse the topmost turrets of the palais, the crimson flag that flew over all, lest the people of Demain forget that the Red Queen's reign had begun in blood. The two Queen's guards maintained a steady jog, brisk enough to make Javel feel as though his lungs would collapse, but after a mile or so, their progress slowed. They were nearing the Rue Grange, the enormous boulevard that bisected Demain. Javel enjoyed exploring the city, but he tried to avoid the Rue Grange when possible, for it was the main entry through Demain's western gate, the beginning of the Pike Road. Javel could not forget that Ali must have gone down this very boulevard in a cage years ago. But Dyer led them in that direction, and Javel had no choice but to follow. The crowds intensified as they closed on the rue. A throng of people seemed to be stuffed down every side street, but the two big Queen's guards were able to push through easily, Javel trailing in their wake. When they emerged onto the rue itself, they were forced to halt. There was simply no more room. The middle of the boulevard had been cleared of people by the approach of hundreds of heavy horse, all marching in neatly ordered lines toward the palais. The ground shook with the impact of their hooves, but Javel could hear nothing over the roar of the crowd. "What is it?" he shouted in Dyer's ear. He half expected Dyer to turn and clout him in return. It had happened before. But Dyer paid him no heed. His eyes were fixed on the endless columns of horse, searching. "There!" he cried. Javel stood on his tiptoes, trying to see over the big men's shoulders. After a few seconds, he spotted something. An open wagon, buried deep in the center of the mort column. Hopping slightly to peer over Galen's shoulder, he saw a figure seated inside the wagon, facing the rear, a hood drawn low over his face. "What is it?" he shouted again, and this time Dyer deigned to notice him, though his lip curled in disgust as he spoke. "It's the Queen, you fucking drunk." Javel wanted to shout back that he wasn't a drunk. He'd been sober for 6 months now, but then Dyer's words struck him. "The Queen?"
"Yes, the Queen," Dyer snarled. "Taken prisoner while we were stuck here playing at nonsense with you."
Javel stood on his tiptoes again, staring at the wagon, which was now nearly in front of them. The line of the shoulders did suggest a woman, and so did the thin wrists, chained to the wagon. As she approached, the roar of the crowd increased, and a piece of what looked like raw meat flew from the other side of the rue, narrowly missing her head.
"What do we do?"
Dyer shouted at Galen. Javel felt the lightest of touches at his waist. He looked down and found a pickpocket, little more than a child, busily exploring beneath his cloak. He shoved the boy away.
"Oh, Jesus!" Galen cried.
Javel looked up again and found the wagon, past them now, far enough that they could see under the prisoner's hood. Someone had worked her over. Her lower lip was busted, and the mother of all shiners adorned her right eye. But those green eyes could not be mistaken. They darted over the crowd even as the people cursed her and clods of mud landed almost in her lap. For one interminable moment,
Javel was certain that her gaze had swept across the three of them, her good eye fixing on his. Then, the wagon dropped out of sight. Dyer began to draw his sword, and Javel felt panic clutch his heart. Was Dyer really going to bring the Mort army down on them all? Now? What about Ali? A hand snaked from behind them to clamp Dyer's wrist, and a voice hissed in Tyr,
"Do nothing."
They whirled to find a group of dark-garbed men standing behind them. The leader was not big, but he was surrounded by larger men, one of them far too big for either Dyer or Galen to take. If this was a Mort patrol, they were all likely dead. Javel considered begging Dyer to tell him where Ali was, in case there was no other chance. Galen had pulled a knife, but the stranger only marked it for a moment, before returning his gaze to Dyer.
"She's beyond your reach at this time, Queen's Guard. Save your strength for another moment. She's bloodied, but not broken. Look."
The three of them turned to look, but the wagon had long since disappeared. The Mort cavalry marched onward, seemingly endless.
"Who are you?"
Galen demanded, turning around again. But the man and his companions had already faded into the crowd. Kelsey's dungeon was 8 feet by 8 feet. She had discovered this by walking the length of each wall, measuring paces. Three of the walls were stone, well built. Kelsey's fingers could detect no cracks or leaks. The fourth wall was made up of iron bars and a door. Beyond them, a hallway of indeterminate length. The sounds from this hallway were not good. Some screaming, some moaning, and down the corridor, one man who could not stop babbling, holding an interminable dialogue with someone named George. The fact that George was not there to hold up his end of the conversation was no impediment to this poor soul, who seemed determined to convince his invisible friend that he was not a thief. There was no way to measure time. They had taken her watch in the camp, and Kelsey was already finding out that the worst of a bad situation was the uncertainty of hours passing. Meals provided some respite, though not much, as they were usually cold vegetables, occasionally combined with some sort of meat that Kelsey could not identify. She forced it down all the same. Meals did not seem to conform to any set schedule, and it could be a long while before the next arrived. Water also came erratically. Kelsey had learned to ration her drinking bucket. She could see very little. The Mort did not allow prisoners so much as a candle. Some of these inmates were undoubtedly being kept alive against their will, for Kelsey had heard more than one voice down the hallway beg for death. She saw the logic behind the deprivation of light. The darkness was, in itself, a terrible thing. She had shown greater kindness to her own prisoners, even to Thorn. But thinking of Thorn was a mistake. By her best guess, Kelsey had been down here for 4 days, and she had discovered that a dungeon was of little use for anything but reflection. Over those last weeks in the keep, watching the Mort draw closer, there had been no time for self-assessment. But here, there was nothing else. And she thought often of Arlen Thorn, kneeling on the platform, his face twisted in agony. He had been a traitor, and a trafficker, a brutal man who did not blanch at torture. He had presented a clear danger to the Tierling. And yet...
"George, you must believe me,"
the man down the hall shouted.
I did not take it.
Kelsey wondered why